You know, we're beginning a new Bible study today. The last few weeks we've been looking at the book of Proverbs, and we have not ceased from that, but it's a big book. Proverbs will take us quite some time to go through, so we've done chapters 1 to 9, which sort of completes one segment of Proverbs. We'll come back to it in a few weeks and keep on going until we complete the whole book. But today we're starting a new Bible study on the book of Daniel. Daniel is quite an important book in the Bible, and in the past we've looked at a few prophets. I think probably 2 or 3 years ago we had a study on the book of Habakkuk, or Habakkuk if you prefer, and then maybe sometime last year, early this year, we looked at Jonah and Nahum and Zephaniah. So that's, I think, 4 books of prophecy that we've looked at already, all notable by being rather small books, rather short books, like Jonah quite short, and Nahum quite short, and Habakkuk quite short. Of course, some of the other books of prophecy that we could well study are, frankly, rather daunting. The book of Isaiah is a very big book. Jeremiah is an equally big book. Daniel is a bit of a compromise. It's only 12 chapters long, so hopefully we can get through it in just a few weeks. Having said that, it is probably one of the more important books of prophecy, because really, I'm sure Mr. Armstrong has said this in the past, without the book of Daniel, you can't understand the book of Revelation. And if you and I want to be better prepared for the end times, we ought to be able to have a decent understanding of Revelation, and that requires us to have a decent understanding of the book of Daniel, because the two sort of go together. And now that we are, we believe, very close to the end time, it probably is important for us to make sure that we don't take our eye off the ball, so to speak. And in terms of prophecy, we do keep an eye on what's taking place. The book of Daniel was written, strange enough, by a man called Daniel, and the story starts around about 605 BC. There's always plenty of room for arguing about exact dates, but roughly 605 BC, Jerusalem was still in existence as a city. It had not quite been sacked and the temple burned at this time. That came about 20 or so years later. And Daniel, as we'll see, was a man who was there in a position of power and influence for a very long time, something like 70 years plus. So assuming that the story begins when he's sort of 15 to 20, that puts Daniel somewhere in his 90s, maybe 100 years old, when he eventually died. So a man who had a long, long span involved in some of the top empires in this world. Daniel was contemporary, that means he was alive the same time as Jeremiah and Ezekiel. All three were prophesying, writing, and so on, roughly the same time. So Jeremiah was in the scene, Ezekiel was in the scene, and Daniel was on the scene. And Daniel must have been really quite a remarkable man. If you open your Bibles, first of all, at Ezekiel chapter 14, there's a couple of references to Daniel in the book of Ezekiel. Let's open at Ezekiel 14, just as a bit of background before we actually start Daniel itself, or Daniel himself. Ezekiel 14, and we'll pick up in verse 13, or verse 12. Ezekiel 14 and verse 12. The word of the Eternal came again to me, Ezekiel, saying, Son of man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off man and beast from it, as indeed was happening to Judah, and is going to happen to other nations that you and I are a lot closer to. Verse 14, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God. So God says that even men as righteous as Noah, Daniel, and Job could only save themselves. But notice Noah, we know that he was quite a special man in God's sight, and Job certainly. Daniel, one of the three. And you think, well, interesting. So clearly Noah and Daniel and Job were three particularly righteous men in God's sight. But the strange thing is that Daniel was still alive at this time. Ezekiel and Daniel lived side by side in terms of years. And so here's Daniel. At this stage of the game, Daniel's probably not even 40 years old. All right? And here's a man who's not yet 40, and the Almighty God himself recognizes that Daniel is a man of outstanding qualities, a man of great integrity. And he's still a comparatively young man. I say that now because I'm a bit older. But, 40s or 38 or 36, whatever age he was, really, just a young sprog. And he's described here as a very righteous man, the equivalent of Noah and Job. Let's turn to Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28. And just to get the context, we'll read verses 1 and 2. Ezekiel 28. The word of the Eternal came to me again, Ezekiel, saying, Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, Thus says the Lord God. So this is a statement made by God to the prince of Tyre. And speaking somewhat sarcastically, verse 3, God says to the prince of Tyre, Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. Are you? There is no secret that can be hidden from you with your wisdom and your understanding and so on. So talking to the prince of Tyre, and if you like, provoking the prince of Tyre, God says to him, So you think you're as wise as Daniel? You're wiser than Daniel, are you indeed, O prince of Tyre? So amazing that Daniel, such a comparatively young man, was recognized, it looks like, by the nations, by peoples, and by God himself, as really an outstanding individual. So really something special. And then, unfortunately, in our day and age, there are many Bible scholars who don't believe there was a Daniel, amazingly enough. Because, you see, when they read the book of Daniel, they recognize there's a large number of very specific prophecies of things that would come to pass, many of which have already come to pass. Now, that strikes them as, like, impossible, because, you know, it surely must be the case that somebody wrote the prophecies after they happened. And so really, Daniel wasn't written around about 600 BC. It was written maybe 150 BC, after lots of events took place. And it's just the Jews have just concocted this imaginary character called Daniel. They refuse to accept that there was a Daniel, that there was a God, and that the God gave Daniel insight, understanding, and prophetic revelation. But I think we can put paid to that. We turn to Matthew 24. Because if we believe there was a Jesus Christ, and that he was the Son of God and spoke the truth, then Jesus tells us there was definitely a Daniel. Matthew 24. And we begin in verse 13, which appears in red letters in my Bible. But he who endures to the end, says Jesus, shall be saved. One of Mr. Armstrong's more popular verses. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by whom? By Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So here's Jesus giving the so-called Olivet prophecy, a major prophecy. And what does he say in verse 15? He talks of the prophet Daniel. And he says, in particular, when you believers, see something called the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, when you see that, standing in the holy place, then watch out. Certain things are going to happen. And clearly, as we go through the book of Daniel, we'll be getting at some later stages to the abomination of desolation, and hopefully find out a bit more about it. But clearly, Jesus believed that there was a Daniel, and in fact told us, if we believe him, that we should be aware of what Daniel wrote. And it says, whoever reads, let him understand. So it really behooves us to do our very best to understand about the abomination of desolation, because it does have an end time fulfillment. Okay, we move back to Daniel, but let's turn to Daniel chapter 12, and we'll almost get ready to begin chapter 1. But Daniel chapter 12 tells us a couple of other things we need to know before we start. I mean, if we're not familiar with the abomination of desolation, if we haven't read the book of Daniel, if we don't have a reasonable grasp of what Daniel was writing about, then how could we respond to Jesus' warning there? He says, when you see the abomination of desolation that Daniel wrote about, when you see it standing in the holy place, then, you know, start running. Take heed. Watch out. So people who choose to ignore the book of Daniel, or choose to assume that it was written by some anonymous character, you know, 300-400 years after the events took place, they're not going to be looking out for some abomination of desolation. They're not going to flee Judea and take other action, because they don't believe Daniel's a real person. But I think you and I, obviously, we see differently. But what about the prophecies of Daniel? Could anybody at any time in the last 2,600 years have understood them? For example, here in this country, there was a gentleman, I think fairly well known to everybody, Sir Isaac Newton, who tells us why an apple falls down from the sky and so on. But Sir Isaac Newton was, amongst other things, apart from being an astronomer, mathematician and so on, was a Bible student who wrote a great deal about the Bible and so on. And he was an avid student of the book of Daniel, wrote commentaries on it. So is it worthwhile that you and I should perhaps get hold of Sir Isaac Newton's understanding and study that to give us insight into the book of Daniel? Would that be useful? Well, Daniel chapter 12, and look at verse 4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. So as Mr. Armstrong made clear to us, the prophecy of Daniel was actually shut up. It was sealed. It couldn't be opened. It couldn't be understood until, as it says here, the time of the end. And if we believe that we're in the time of the end, and I guess we do, then now is the days, or now are the days, when you and I can hope to understand the book. Shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end. And many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Obviously at the time of the end. Drop down to verse 9. It repeats pretty much. And the angel said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. So in effect, there probably isn't much benefit in you and I digging around in the commentaries written 50 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, because, whilst I suppose, to be fair, there may be some bits and pieces that you and I can pick up on, the main understanding from Daniel has to really come today, in our day and age. And Mr. Armstrong said, of course, those days had come in his lifetime, and that after, you know, centuries of being sealed, the book of Daniel and, of course, the book of Revelation, was his book called? The book of Revelation unveiled at last. And that too was sealed, that had been opened up in our day and age. Looking at verse 4, just before we leave it, as an interesting little aside here, it says, but you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro. There's a former Pharisee named Nehemiah Gordon who runs a website. You've probably come across it, some of you, called Karite Corner. And Mr. Gordon says that in modern-day Israel, the expression run to and fro, the Hebrew for that is what they use today for the term surfing internet. You know, running to and fro, going back and forwards, I think some translations say, is exactly the Hebrew phrase for surfing the internet. Now, that's what he says. I don't know whether he's accurate or not, but if he was, then we could translate verse 4 as, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. many shall serve the internet, and knowledge shall increase. Which sort of sounds actually rather accurate, but that's an aside. Okay, let's turn to Daniel chapter 1, and let's see what took place. Daniel chapter 1, and obviously beginning in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And Nebuchadnezzar features quite a lot in the book of Daniel, and in fact he actually wrote one of the chapters himself. It's quite something that a Gentile king should be one of the co-authors of scripture, but that's the way it happens. And Nebuchadnezzar was clearly quite an exceptional individual from many points of view, but he was here attacking the city of Jerusalem. He did that several times over the years. This was around about 605 BC. He didn't finally destroy it and the temple for another 20 or so years. So there was a short span left after this when the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah had a little bit more time to come to their senses, but didn't. Verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, the temple, which he carried into the land of Shinar, that's to Babylon, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. And it's interesting, I suppose, to notice that even here in the early verses, it says that this was really God's doing. It says that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. There's no way that Nebuchadnezzar, of course, thought it that way. As far as he was concerned, it was his military might, his precision, his appetite for war, his ruthlessness, and so on. He saw it really as, you know, I'm the great Nebuchadnezzar, I'm the man, I'm the head honcho, and I'm doing this through my own strength and power. In reality, he came to see later on that actually, and whilst he'd certainly a part to play, there's no question that you know, God was intervening here. Verse 3. Then the king, Nebuchadnezzar, instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men, in whom there was no blemish but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. So, in a sense, the king wanted to, you know, add to his officials and add talent. And he said, look, you know, I guess he thought perhaps somewhat highly of the nation of Judah and some of its people. And he said, look, let's get some of the best that are there, some of the younger folk, the ones who are, you know, particularly striking in their looks, who seem to be quite intelligent, good minds, quick-witted, and let's bring them into the palace, and let's sharpen them up. Let's teach them our language, our literature, our skills, astronomy, mathematics, and so on, and then they can add value to my court. I'm looking for intelligent young individuals, and that was fine. It says in verse 3 that the king started Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, and some people suggest, and possibly correctly, that the individuals who were brought from Judah were made eunuchs. That's possible. It's not categorically clear, because some translations, such as the New American Standard Bible, refer to Ashpenaz as the chief of his officials, the chief of Nebuchadnezzar's officials. And the term which the New King James refers to as eunuchs is actually quite a common term just for officer or official throughout the Old Testament. In fact, if you think back to the book of Genesis and the story of Joseph when he went down to Egypt, and he served, if you remember, as in Potiphar's house for a while, and Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him on one occasion and grabbed hold of him and he ran off and so on and so forth, ended up in jail. Well, Potiphar was a chief official, same a Hebrew word as translated eunuch. It seems highly unlikely that Potiphar would be a eunuch with a wife. I don't see how that would work. So it's quite likely that Ashpenaz just was indeed a chief official, and it doesn't suggest necessarily that these young guys were all made eunuchs. But that's perhaps not here nor there, unless you're one of them, in which case it might be very much here or there. Verse 5. And the king appointed for these individuals, and doesn't say how many there were, maybe a couple of dozen or more, a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. And to be fair, this is all really quite sensible. When you took over a nation, you didn't just batter them totally into submission. You took the best that they had, the young talent, whether it was from Judah or from Europe or from India, and you trained them up. And that way you would certainly improve your abilities. Now, from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them, the chief of the eunuchs, or the chief officer, gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego, or Abednego. So that's the sort of famous Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or shake the bed, make the bed, and into bed you go, as some people refer to them. We tend not to know their sort of Jewish names, Hebrew names, as much as their sort of Babylonian names. Other than Daniel, of course, and we still refer to as Daniel, despite him being called Belteshazzar. Verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs, or the chief officer, that he might not defile himself. It doesn't say exactly what the problem was here. It could have been unclean foods. The king's delicacies might have been octopus and prawns and snake sausages and who knows what not. Or maybe it was some clean things that just weren't killed properly. I mean, if you strangle animals, that's unacceptable in God's sight. And of course, it could be other reasons as well. Maybe Daniel didn't like the idea that the meat and stuff came from some of the idol services. Equally, it says here he didn't like the wine either. So Daniel decided that, nope, I'm not for this. And if you think of this for a moment, Daniel was a very young man. It doesn't say exactly how old he was, but tradition, which I don't like relying on, but Jewish tradition puts him somewhere around about 15, 16, 17. So here's a guy who's definitely no more than a teenager. He's taken captive and carted off to another country. Strange language, strange people, ruthless people, and he's being offered food that he does not want. Now, many folk would say, I think it'd be wise to just go along with the flow here. Don't want to stick my head above the parapet in case it gets chopped off. These Babylonians are a pretty rough lot. So you could, perhaps imagine Daniel just keeping his head down. But he didn't. He said, no, it's not for me. No, no way. And despite being a very young man in his teens, he stood up and said, halt. Nope, not prepared to do this. And he took a stand. And that says something about Daniel, and I guess that's a good indicator as to where Daniel was going and why, even in Ezekiel's lifetime, and Daniel's lifetime, he was referred to as, as righteous, as Noah and Job, and a very wise man. Verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And so you see God still involved here. God's working out his purpose and his plan. He's brought these young men to Babylon, and now he's, in a sense, God is helping these young men progress to remarkable heights. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you'd endanger my head before the king. And he wasn't joking. Nebuchadnezzar had a fairly short temper by the sound of it, and quite a ruthless individual. And if he wanted these young men to be trained, taught, educated in the lore and learning of the Chaldeans, and discover they look a sickly lot, coughing and wheezing and so on, and their hair dropping out, and he says, what's going on there? Well, they didn't want to eat your food, O king, so I've let them eat some other stuff. he says, not having that, your head's off straight away, chief of eunuchs, you're no longer chief of eunuchs, you're now chief of the cemetery. And it's like, so these guys are very careful. The king wasn't the sort of person that you wanted to offend. So Daniel, verse 11, said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please, test your servants for 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. So it was a bit of a sort of compromise of sorts. And say, look, let's just let's try this out, shall we? And so this is wisdom. He's not, you know, kicking up a big rumpus here. He's not going in a huff. He says, look, let's just try something, shall we? You know, Mr. Steward, for just 10 days, just a week and a half, let's just have vegetables and water. Okay, verse 13, then let our countenances be examined before you, and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. Okay? So the other guys that you've got here, the other young men, you just feed them on, you know, octopus pie and hedgehog and other stuff and whatever else comes out of the king's kitchens. But for us, it's going to be, you know, lettuce and tomatoes and, you know, hazelnuts and glasses of water. And then 10 days' time, you compare, and then up to you. We'll leave it in your hands because you're a wise steward. Steward must have thought, no harm in that. 10 days and out of here and there. Verse 14. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, remarkable, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. So they were all perhaps, you know, red-eyed and blotchy and whatever. And Daniel and his three friends looked pretty good. Verse 16. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. But good to see that, you know, Daniel stood up, you could say, against the might of the Babylonian Empire, because you didn't get much higher than this. The chief official to Nebuchadnezzar and the steward who was personally supervising the progress of these young men. Verse 17. And as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So again, you know, God's involved here. And of course, if God gave them knowledge and skill in literature and wisdom, then of course, he can certainly give to others too, including, for example, the likes of you and me. You know, God can give gifts and gifts of knowledge. Certainly. And so these young men must have progressed very rapidly, learning the Chaldean language, learning about astronomy and mathematics, history, and becoming, you know, really quite useful. Verse 18. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs, or the chief officer, brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, that would be the whole bunch of them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding by which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. So, you know, God's working out a purpose here, and it's pretty clever, really. You know, here are, if you like, you know, four young slave boys from Judah, a captive nation. And where are they? They're in high office, if you like, and greatly respected before King Nebuchadnezzar. He was, if you like, the world ruler of that day. So can God do things? Amazingly, yeah. He can get his men, his women, whatever, exactly where he needs them. And who can say in the end time events that there may not be some very wise people very close to, you know, some top dogs in the end time empire. Verse 21. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus, and that was some 70 odd years later. This was long after Nebuchadnezzar had gone and sundry others. King Cyrus came along about 70 years after this. So just telling us that Daniel reached high office, highly respected, and he remained that way through generation after generation, and from various kings to various kings, and King Cyrus was about 70 years after that, and Daniel was still going strong in his day. So really quite an important individual, Daniel, and very influential. And God had brought him right up to be, if you like, sitting there at the very reins of power of the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 2. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. And when you look at sort of dates and chronology and Bible terms, sometimes it's quite hard to get a proper handle on it. It talks about the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and some say, well, you know, Nebuchadnezzar co-reigned with his father for a couple of 3 years, then he reigned on his own after that for another 40 odd years. So this second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign might have been maybe 4 or 5 years after Daniel came on the scene. And that seems to make some sense, and you'll see why in a moment or two. So anyway, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it wasn't a good dream. It says his spirit was so troubled that he just woke up, sort of stunned, astonished, perhaps horrified at what he dreamt, and amazed, and he's just thinking, wow, what was all that about? And so verse 2, then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and he probably did it the very same night. So here come all the wise guys to appear before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king said to them, verse 3, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. I want to understand this dream. It was an astonishing dream. It's left me really badly troubled and anxious, and I need to know more. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, and the rest of chapter 2 and chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 are all in Aramaic, strangely enough. So the Old Testament is mostly written in Hebrew, but the next sort of five chapters are all in Aramaic. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Of course, that's open to abuse. Somebody says, well, I sort of dreamt of this marshmallow flying through the sky, and this dog was chasing after it. The dog jumped up in the air, suddenly it's spreading wings, and then, oh, well, that means is that that you're looking for a long-lost love, and, you know, it's all baloney, basically. And maybe the king, you know, suspected as much. But anyway, the Chaldeans said, okay then, fair enough, tell us what happened, O king, O great king, live forever, and we'll tell you what it meant. But the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. He was not one to win friends and influence people exactly, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar. He was quite a hard man. The King James Version says, the thing has gone from me, meaning I can't actually remember the dream. But whether it's that or not, the point is, you know, he wasn't giving them any insight at all. You tell me the dream and its interpretation. Okay, verse 6. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. Come on, fair is fair. You tell us what you dreamt, and we will tell you what it means. The king answered verse 8 and said, I know for certain that you would gain time because you see my decision is firm or the thing has gone from me. If you do not make known the dream to me, there's only one decree for you. For you've agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed or situation has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. The more he's convincing himself. If they can't tell me the dream, how can I trust their lousy interpretation? If they can tell me what I dreamt, then that gives me confidence that they're giving me a true interpretation. So he's putting his feet down now. No, you are the experts. You tell me what I dreamed, and then tell me what it meant. Otherwise, you'll be cut in pieces, and your houses will be an ash heap. The Chaldeans, verse 10, answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. No one's ever asked that before. You know, only a madman would, they're thinking, oops, bit gone too far there. It's a difficult thing that the king requires, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. So, sorry, mate, but you're out of luck. Can't be done. Have some common sense, O king. You know, nobody's ever asked that sort of question before. It's ridiculous. For this reason, verse 12, the king was very angry and very furious and gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. He wasn't a man to trifle with, was he? And he was ruthless. And he was, that's it, okay, you guys can't do it. I'm having none of you. There's no point you're drawing breath. So all of you are dead from this point on. Verse 13, so the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, probably starting with that lot there, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. So this precise time, Daniel and if the other friends of his were somewhere away, but anyway, off go the armed men with their swords and whatnot, and anybody who's a wise man, astrologer, sorcerer, or Chaldean is, the time is up. Now whether that's going to be 100 or 250 or 1,000, no way of telling. But all the wise men were, down to the last few hours because the king had it. That's it. Well, I've had a dream. I don't know where it is. I have no idea. I've forgotten it. It's important to me. It must have been important. It's struck me as being important. I must know, and these guys can't tell me, so that's it. I'm going to kill them all. Verse 14. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon, and answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent, or so harsh, or so hasty? I mean, has the king really, thought this through properly? Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Because clearly, if nothing changed, they'd be goners as well. So they think, well, let's go to God. Let's ask God to give us wisdom here and to give us insight and to reveal the secret so that we can answer Nebuchadnezzar's demands, and that will save our necks and I guess the other guys as well. So they went and prayed to God in verse 19. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So God answered that particular prayer and clearly lining up Daniel for some really big benefits here, because Nebuchadnezzar is busy jumping about, killing people everywhere because he wants his dream answered. He knows it's an important dream, but what did it mean? And look, God's just lining things up here very shortly. The king's going to look at Daniel with astonishment and just think Daniel is the best thing since bread and butter was invented. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Verse 20, Daniel answered and said to God, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the season. He removes kings and raises up kings. And God does. Daniel, I think, understood that even in a great Gentile empire, God's hands were visible. God's direction was visible. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you. We have made known to us the king's demand. Verse 24. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. Which is like good news for everybody, really, especially the wise men. And Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man, no harm in taking a bit of credit here, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. And then maybe Arioch himself got a few brownie points from being the man who had discovered Daniel. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Oh, are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation? Is this correct? Can you do this?" Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king." They can't do it. "But there is a God in heaven who reveals the secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days." And there's probably several different sort of things happening here. You know, one is, remember, Nebuchadnezzar must have felt that he was it. He was the king of the world-ruling Babylonian Empire. There was none greater on the earth, and he used his power, you know, quite ruthlessly at times. And yet, you know, here God is giving a message to Nebuchadnezzar. And that message, amongst other things, is showing that actually Nebuchadnezzar, God's in control. He raises up kings, he'll bring down kings. He raises up kingdoms, he'll bring them down. What's happened to you, Nebuchadnezzar, is only because, you know, God is working certain things out, and you happen to be a part of them. "Your dream," verse 28 still, "and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be." But notice just verse 28 before we move away, it says, God has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. So the dream that we're about to read and the interpretation that Daniel's about to give, which all came from God, were about what's going to happen in the latter days. Now, I suppose people want to argue about what is the latter days and so on and so forth. But I think most of us believe that we're in the latter days. And that being the case, then this dream and its interpretation have got something to do with 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, because these are the latter days. And God was revealing to King Nebuchadnezzar and to us as well, thanks to it being written down, things that are relevant to the latter days. So it's not just ancient writings of things long since passed away that are of no relevance. If you and I want to know about the latter days, such as the days we're living in, here's some information. Verse 30, "As for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image," or some translations say, "a great statue." And maybe you've seen the sort of drawings that the Worldwide Church of God used to produce in Mr. Armstrong's day. There's a great statue with all the different colored metals. "This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome." So here in your dream, Nebuchadnezzar, you're standing, and suddenly there's a huge big statue of a man right in front of you. And it's huge, and it's excellent, and it's awesome, and obviously your breath's taken away. Verse 32, "This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly iron, partly clay." And so there's that great statue there with these four different sort of metals, gold and silver and bronze and then iron, and the iron peeking out at the end into a sort of mixture of iron and clay. And you just watched and you saw it standing there. But then verse 34, "You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." So here's a stone cut out of a neighboring mountain or something. It hurls its way through the air, smashes the feet of this great statue. The feet break into smithereens. And then verse 35, "Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream." And of course you can imagine that Nebuchadnezzar thinking, spot on. Absolutely spot. I'd forgotten some of those details, but he's right. there was a stone and it did smash, and yeah, there was a wind came up and like a hurricane, and it blew all the dust and the fragments away, and then with nothing left, and then the stone expanded and grew and developed, and wow, that's exactly the dream. Now of course that alone could have given Nebuchadnezzar enormous confidence, because anybody can tell you what you dreamed the night before, obviously he's onto something. Carrying on verse 36, now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. Even more interesting, thinks the king. Now he's probably sitting in the front of his seat thinking, wow, okay, we know what I dreamed. Now what was it all about? What does it mean for me? You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength and glory. So another little reminder here, by the way, that Nebuchadnezzar, it wasn't just, you know, your great good looks, your talent, you've actually been the recipient here of some of God's handiwork. You, O king, are a king of kings, verse 37, for the God of heaven, he has given you a kingdom, power, strength, glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So, you know, obviously teaching Nebuchadnezzar a thing or two that, like I say, God was involved here, God's handiwork. But notice that the head of gold in the statue represented Nebuchadnezzar. And since the king represented his kingdom, the head of gold represents, you know, the nation or the empire of Babylon. Verse 39, but after you, so this is a sequence now, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and that would be, of course, the silver kingdom, because the head was of gold, but then the chest and arms were of silver. So after the gold comes the silver kingdom, which it says is inferior to yours, and inferior in some ways, but of course, as been pointed out by various writers, that silver is stronger than gold, and bronze is stronger than silver, and iron stronger than them all. So probably a militarily stronger nation, but in many ways not up to the standard. And so really it sounds like, you know, Babylon was in some ways the creme de la creme. And what was the silver kingdom? Well, we believe, and I think it's quite commonly understood by many Bible students and scholars and churches, that would be the Medo-Persian Empire, because after Babylon, it was the Persian Empire, which was joined with the Medes, so you had what they called the Medo-Persian Empire, but you could say Persian Empire, and that's where, of course, Iran is today. We used to call Persia, Persia. Now we call it Iran, because that's what they call it. And I think the Iranians didn't like being called Persia too much, so some years back they insisted that they were referred to as Iran. But we've often called it Persia. When I was a kid, it was referred to, at least in Scotland, as Persia, and the Shah of Persia and so on, but that empire is now what we know as Iran. Then it says, verse 39, a third kingdom of bronze which shall rule over all the earth. So we have a sequence of kingdoms here. The Babylonian kingdom, then the silver kingdom, Persia, then a third kingdom of bronze which will rule over the whole earth, and that was the Greek empire. Now I've got some of the years here, but rough and ready, but Babylon ran from Nebuchadnezzar's day down to about 539 BC. And then you had the Medo-Persian Empire, the Silver Empire, that ran down to about 331-ish BC. And then the Greek Empire ran until verse 40. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. So each metal seemingly stronger and harder than the ones before, but much less valuable in many ways. Iron doesn't have the value of gold or silver. And this fourth kingdom was, of course, the Roman Empire. And remember that the statue had two legs, and the legs were of iron. That's been taken by us and by many other Bible students to be the fact that the Roman Empire had two divisions, the East and the West. the east was Constantinople, or I think Istanbul today, where some of the emperors ruled for many centuries, and of course the western part of the Roman Empire was Rome itself. So the Roman Empire was the empire of iron and had two broad divisions, just like the two legs of the great statue. But carrying on in the explanation to Nebuchadnezzar, verse 41, whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom, this iron kingdom, shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. So this statue exists all the way down to a certain event that we're about to read of, but at the very end of its lifespan, the toes and the feet are partly iron, partly clay, not a very good mixture. It's sort of strongish, but I'll give it a good bash with a hammer and it'll just fragment. It's not very strong at all, iron and clay mixed together. And what we're saying is that there are, and Mr. Armstrong's explanation, which I go along with, is that there are 10 toes on this statue at the bottom, and the 10 toes are the 10 nations who are united together at the return of Jesus Christ. But they don't unite very strongly, because like iron and clay, they're sort of stuck together, but it's not very powerful sort of combination, and it breaks quite easily. Because notice verse 44, in the days of these kings, that would be the 10 toes at the end of the statue's life, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And what you've got here, if you think about it, is really five kingdoms. There's the Babylonian kingdom, followed by the Persian kingdom, followed by the Greek kingdom, followed by the Roman kingdom, followed by the kingdom of God. Simple as that. It's only those kingdoms. And since the other four kingdoms are real kingdoms with real kings ruling over real subjects on a real earth, Mr. Armstrong would say, why accept anything different from the fifth kingdom? The kingdom of God is a real kingdom ruling on a real earth over real people with a real king. Because they're all just like each other. There's gold, silver, bronze, iron, and then this final kingdom. And so, whereas many Protestants and so on will teach you that the kingdom of God is something within you, some sort of ethereal, fluffy bunny feeling in your heart, is reading Daniel is talking about real king. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't interested in fluffy bunny stuff, the pink fluffy world of Protestantism. He was interested in government, empires, ruling, kings, subjects. And says Daniel, God's revealing to you what's going to happen. There's going to be, four phases, gold, silver, bronze, and iron. But in the tail end, the toe end of the iron empire, it says, verse 44, in the days of these kings, and we believe there are 10 nations somewhat united, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom, that will be the kingdom of God, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. They shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. This kingdom doesn't just last for 300 years or whatever, it lasts forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And that amazed Nebuchadnezzar. Now, just before we move on a bit, the stone, if you turn to 1 Peter chapter 2, 1 Peter chapter 2 is one of the places where we see Jesus referred to as a stone, no great surprise. First Peter chapter 2, and picking up in verse 4. First Peter chapter 2, verse 4. Coming to him, to Jesus, as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built into a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, it is also contained in the scripture, "Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he who believes on him will by no means be put to shame. Therefore, to you who believe, he, Jesus, is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense." There's other places as well, but Jesus is referred to as a stone. And he is indeed this stone which will destroy these empires. And then, of course, Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, ruling in the kingdom of God, the fifth kingdom. And so this was a sort of snapshot to King Nebuchadnezzar, just saying, well, okay, King, you're this head of gold, you're this very valuable empire, and God's given it to you, but obviously, you know, your days will end, and after you'll be another empire of silver. After that, Nebuchadnezzar will come an empire of bronze. After that, Nebuchadnezzar will come an empire of iron. It will stretch down a long way. Towards the end, it will be very weak in some ways. It'll have some strength, like iron, but will be mixed with clay and will be a bit fragile. And in those days, O King Nebuchadnezzar, the God of heaven is going to set up his kingdom on this earth. And, of course, that's all true. The dream is certain. The interpretation, it says, is sure. Verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. That's something, isn't it? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is not a wilting wallflower. This guy is like, you know, who knows how many people he's had put to death. And now he just falls on his face on the floor before Daniel, the Jew, with all these courtiers looking on, and commanded that they should bring an offering and incense to him. The king answered, Daniel said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Pretty clever, isn't it? Look where God has got Daniel, from being a slave, carted off in captivity. And look who now, in fact, is in practice, the ruler of the Babylonian Empire. The man Daniel. He's ruler, it says, over the whole province of Babylon, and he's the chief administrator over all the wise men. Verse 49, also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate, or the court, of the king. So now the three friends of Daniel are also in amazingly high places. So it really is something special to see how God can work these events out. And this took no time at all, because although the chronology is not too easy to grasp, this is only something like maybe 3 or 4 years after Daniel has arrived in Babylon. So Daniel could only be maybe at this stage 20, 21, 22. Not too sure exactly, but certainly, put it this way, he's still an extremely young man, barely 21 years old, and he's now over the Babylonian Empire, and he's now head of all the wise men, which of course they wouldn't be too pleased with that. Chapter 3, some years has now elapsed. I've got an idea it's something like 15, 16, 17 years later, so time has moved on, and perhaps Nebuchadnezzar has forgotten some of his lessons. He got a bit carried away. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and his width 6 cubits. That's about 90 foot high, a 9 or 10 story high sort of statue, and 9 feet across. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So here's your man setting up this great image. covered in gold, and he's calling everybody that he can think of to come to essentially worship it. Verse 3, so the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And he stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, because he didn't say no to King Nebuchadnezzar. Otherwise, it's a fairly brief period and no need for a pension. Then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples and nations and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, so when you hear the orchestra play, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Okay. Slight sting the tail. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. So there was a bit of an incentive plan here. When you get the orchestra, get down on your knees and worship. If you don't get down on your knees and worship, we have an alternative for you, which is being roasted. Verse 7, so at the time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So Nebuchadnezzar, a man of some influence in those days, but you can see here a sort of a hint of something yet to come. We turn to Revelation 13, because, surprise, surprise, there'll be another image in later years, and people will be required to worship it, otherwise they'll be not collecting a very lengthy pension. Revelation 13, and we'll dip in and out here a little bit, starting in verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast, we'll cover that in a moment, in his presence, and causes the earth and those who had gone to worship their first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. So here's Nebuchadnezzar saying, you all better come together and worship this image. Verse 13, he performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. So I guess be on your guard against that type of apparent miracle. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast. He was wounded by the sword and lived. So here's an image being created and set up. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. Fascinating. That the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Well, yo-ho-ho, just like Nebuchadnezzar. Doesn't say here that an orchestra will play, but, you know, the same, more or less the same sort of model. Image, worship it, or be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, and every language and tongue and nation, people, etc., to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. So it says there, you better fall down and worship this image, otherwise you will be killed. Getting back to verse 7, talking of the beast, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe and tongue and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So there is coming a time, and we're not studying Revelation now, obviously, we go back to Daniel. There is coming a time when, you know, it talks of the image of the beast, and every tribe and tongue and people will have to worship the beast and accept the mark of the beast or be killed. So you can see, in a sense, that Nebuchadnezzar's image has a certain connection there. Verse 8 of Daniel 3, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans, of course, were not happy, I guess, to be in second place any longer, came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the orchestra shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Now, there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. So, we know where this is going to end up, don't we? And of course, when we get to the tribulation, there may be some of God's people who are given a choice along this sort of a nature. There's the image. Here's the mark. Do you or don't you? Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego?" Remember, these were high officials now in his kingdom. "That you do not serve my gods, or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time that you hear the orchestra, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. That's fine. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Ha ha. Obviously, 18, 16 years have passed, and Nebuchadnezzar has lost a little bit of the plot. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, that you throw us into the burning fiery furnace, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." And there's two ways of understanding verse 18. One is, the more common understanding is, if he throws into the fire, our God will deliver us, but if he doesn't deliver us, well, we'll burn up and won't serve your God, which sort of doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The other alternative is that if he throws into the burning fiery furnace, our God will deliver us. But if you don't throw us in, we still won't serve you and your stupid gods. Simple as that. So neither way, any way, under any circumstances, will we serve your gods or worship your silly gold image. Whether you throw us into the fire or not, we're not doing it. Verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed towards Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. That's why I think they'd said, "Look, even if you don't throw us in," he was thinking, "I'll be merciful. I'm going to throw you into the fire unless you worship the image, but even if you didn't do that, Nebuchadnezzar, even if you showed mercy and compassion and recognized that we're important to you, we still wouldn't do it." And so he spurned his offer of compassion, and so he gets really enraged. His face is full of fury, and he says, "Heat up the furnace seven times more." So he really is filled with hate and animosity towards these guys now. Verse 20, and he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. I mean, what made him so livid? You'd have thought these guys saying, "Well, I'm sorry, we're going to go into the fire. That's what you're intending to do to us. Well, we'll trust our God and he will deliver us. If he doesn't, well, we're still going in." He would have thought, "Whoa, what an amazing display of faith and trust and stupidity." But there we go, throw them in. But I think because he must have been offering them some opportunity to escape, and they just spurned it and said, "No way, we're not going to worship your God, your image. Impossible, never going to happen." That's what really got him into such a tiz was. Verse 21, then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Must have been pretty hot. If to try and get them into the fire, the guys who were carrying them there got slain by the flames and the heat. So we're talking of a pretty hot burning fiery furnace. And these guys were strong men of valor, and they were all killed. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" He wasn't worried about the sort of 12 dead soldiers lying nearby all shriveled up with the heat. He said, "I thought we threw three men in there." And they answered and said, "True, O king." I mean, these guys were sycophants, weren't they? If he said, "Didn't we throw in, you know, two ice cream cornets and a monkey?" They said, "True, O king." Look, he answered, "I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." So he says, "Hang on, we threw three in." "Yes, yes, O king, whatever you say, O king, it's true, O king, O king, O king." He says, "Well, I can see four walking about, four of them. Where did them come from? And the fourth one looks like the Son of God or a son of God." And he was astonished because they're walking about, even though they were, you know, bound up before they went in, and that could have been, you know, iron chains and things. And then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, but perhaps not too near, and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God," so I think his memory is flooding back now of earlier discussions, "come out and come here. I'm giving you permission to come out of that burning fiery furnace where you're walking about with some fourth person." And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. I mean, just read over that, but I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Here's a fire that is so hot. And the king says, "Make it seven times hotter." I'm sure they made it hot, hot, and to the point where the soldiers lying dead all nearby, because the heat just and the blast coming out when they opened the doors was such that they're all lying there, you know, their shoes smouldering and their hair singed and they're all dead. And here's three guys who've been walking about among the flames. And the king, obviously, what would you be? You'd be totally, you know, gobsmacked. And he says, "Come out, come out, servants of the Most High God." Verse 27, "And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Can God save his people in the midst of a fire?" Well, absolutely. If you turn to Isaiah 43 just for a moment, just read a couple of verses. Isaiah 43. And for some people in the tribulation, these verses might become more relevant. But Isaiah 43, just read verses 1 and 2. It sort of has an echo to the experience of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. "But now," verse 41, verse 1 of chapter 43, "but now thus says the Eternal, who created you, O Jacob, and he who formed you, Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you, for I am the Lord your God." So there may well be a time in the future when people are walking through rivers and walking through fire, and it says that at this particular time the fire will not burn them and the flame will not scorch them. So back to Daniel and the story of these three individuals. Of course, if you read the Catholic Bible, there's a bit that's missing here, because the Catholic Bible and the Apocrypha has the so-called Song of the Three Holy Children. So it's a lot longer, this chapter, in the Catholic Bible, because the Song of the Three Holy Children is the song that apparently they sang whilst they were walking about among the flames. Probably not inspired, just added by some other writer somewhere along the line. So verse 28, as we come to a conclusion, "Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces." and their houses be made in ash heap. He seemed to quite like that, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So once again, Nebuchadnezzar reminded of God's great power. Here he issues a decree that very few people would have gone against, that nobody better speak amiss about this God of heaven. So, you know, God is working things out here. And at the end of it, of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are promoted, and even probably more influential, more powerful. But what a lesson there for Nebuchadnezzar, what a lesson there of a people who walked in faith, put their trust in God, and could walk through the fire unscorched and unharmed. Okay, brethren, that's a reasonable start, chapters 1 to 3 of the book of Daniel. So I guess we'll conclude there for today.